and particularly about this manuscript that you see at the bottom, called the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844. Now, these were little kind of fragmentary notes which Marx wrote and which were never published in his own lifetime. They were published only in the 20th century, and they have become very important in what's sometimes called Marxist humanism, particularly in Eastern Europe. Now, there are two reasons why I want to talk about this today. First of all, and why it's important to go back to this, these funny little notes which Marx wrote over 100 years ago. The first reason is that I think it's very important at this stage of world history that we get out of this godless communism bag, you see, which is meaningless, you know, really, and get out of this very simplistic way of talking about Marxism. And the reason why it's very important to do that is that unless we get a little bit more subtlety in our understanding of Marxism, we're going to destroy the world, you see, because we can't go on with this kind of black and white attitude, which is splitting the world into Christian and communist camps. So we have to get out of that simplistic attitude about Marxism, and I think one of the ways to do that is to go back and recognize the theological foundations of Marxism. And that may sound kind of surprising to talk about the theological foundations of Marxism, but it is quite true that Marx's own analysis, on which he based his more mature thinking, came out of what is called the left Hegelian school. And the left Hegelian school were essentially kind of radical Lutheran theologians of the early 19th century. And just as a kind of parenthesis, I think maybe we ought to bracket this stuff about Marx the Jew, because in fact Marx was never raised in any way as a Jew. He was raised as a Lutheran. And his actual theological and religious affinities were with these kind of left-wing Lutheran theologians, who were, of course, certainly heretics from the point of view of the Orthodox Church. But nevertheless, that was the kind of philosophical tradition out of which he came. And what I want to show you today is the way in, I have to do it in a very simplified way, but the way in which his own thinking really stands in that succession of left-wing Hegelianism. Now, the second reason, which I sort of alluded to at the beginning, why it's important to go back to this, is both because Christians had better understand communism in a more subtle way, and also because this early Marx has become very important for what you might call new left Marxist thinking, or perhaps better to call it Marxist humanist thinking, in Eastern Europe. In other words, since the denunciation of Stalin by Khrushchev, in 1956, there has developed a whole kind of new school of critical Marxist thinking, which attempts to stand over against the dogmatism of the party, stand over against the rigid scientism, the rigid dogmatism, the rigid almost kind of like papalism, you might say, of the party, and to create what is called a Marxist humanism. And one of the ways that they have sought to do this is to sort of like Protestantism over against the Pope or something. They have sought to do this by going back to the sources. And one of the sources that they have used has been the early Marx, which of course the party scorns as an immature Marxism, which is of no account. But these Marxist humanists have gone back to this early Marx and have uncovered beneath Marx's economic system a kind of philosophical humanistic system which based itself not on class struggle, but rather went to the step behind class struggle, which was the alienation of man. And it's on the basis of that concept of alienation that they have tried to create a Marxist humanism. And also, this Marxist humanism has become very much the basis on which Christian Marxist dialogue has been carried out between Christian theologians, particularly in Germany and Eastern Europe, and Marxist philosophers. And later on, I think next week I'm going to talk about Christian Marxist dialogue. So this has become an important kind of new ecumenism, you might say, of a humanized Marxism kind of recovering its own humanistic and to some extent theological roots and Christianity. Now, in a very simplified way, let me try to show you how Marx's position comes out of left-wing Hegelianism. I don't know how, I have sort of little, kind of a little summary there on the board. Basically, Marx's position, which he was playing around with in these manuscripts of 1844, stands in this succession here, from Hegel to Feuerbach to Moses Hess. Now, Hegel, the category here that was used is the category of alienation. Hegel talked about, he constructed a world, sort of a world historical philosophy on the basis of a concept of alienation of God into creation, that God sort of alienates himself or pours himself out, objectifies himself in the form of creation. It was kind of pantheistic philosophy in a way, constructed on a concept of dialectic. God pours himself out into creation. By his creative process, he sort of makes himself into an object to himself, the objectification of God into creation. And through this self-objectification, God gradually realizes himself through the world historical process. That's Hegel. So Hegel, I mean, this is very simplified, of course, but so Hegel had a kind of alienation of God into creation, and then through history, God realizes himself through his own self-objectification or self-alienation. And this is the way Hegel understood the concept of incarnation. He understood incarnation not as just God's coming into man in the form of Jesus, but he understood this in terms of humanity as a whole. It's humanity, creation as a whole, which is God's incarnation. Now, Feuerbach, in effect, sort of reversed this Hegelian concept of alienation. Feuerbach said that all this is a kind of mystification of the real process, that what the real process is that man alienates himself into God as his own objectification of his inner human riches, that actually it's not that God comes into man, but man projects himself in the form of God. And the sort of slogan that's often used to understand Feuerbach is to say that theology is anthropology, that actually all the symbols about God are really symbols about man, sort of projected on the heavens, so to speak. So the basic alienation in Feuerbach is kind of reversed. According to Feuerbach, a man alienates himself into the otherness of God, and in this way he can contemplate his own inner riches. But in so doing, that he sort of basically impoverishes himself, because he projects all his riches into God, and then he sees himself as just a kind of completely depraved, impoverished being. He's nothing. God is everything. And he sort of falls down before this infinitely rich God who contains all of his own riches, and then he sees himself as completely depraved, having nothing whatsoever, and everything is God. And of course, Feuerbach was playing on this extreme Christian kind of talk about God is everything, man is nothing, and so on. So Feuerbach sort of reversed the alienation, said that actually man alienates himself in the form of God. Then he becomes completely impoverished. He has a completely demoralized concept of himself. And therefore, what the theologian or the human historical process is doing and should do in this stage of modern history is for man to recover himself, to recover all the riches that he has projected into God. And in so doing, he will realize himself, because it will not be merely his individual self that he will recover, but he will recover all of the riches of mankind. All the riches of mankind, which have been sort of focused in the symbol of God, will come back to man and will be a way of enriching mankind as a whole and creating a human community where there were simply individuals before. Now the recovery of all of the human riches from the symbol of God will be the creation of what Feuerbach called the species humanity, or the human community, the creation of a kind of sense of the solidarity of man. Now, essentially, Moses Hess stands in this line of the Feuerbach concept of theology as anthropology, but he sort of took it a step lower, you might say, and said that this religious alienation is only a kind of ideological superstructure of the real alienation. that the real alienation is the economic alienation of man, that man projects his creativity into commodities, into things, and ultimately into money, that money is the worldly god into which man has alienated his creativity, and that the religious alienation is only a kind of a superstructure or a symbolism for this underlying alienation of man in the economic process. Now, Marx then sort of stands in this succession from Moses Hess, that Marx took over from Moses Hess the concept that the alienation of man into God is really a symbolism for the underlying alienation, which was the alienation of man's creativity into the economic process, by which man alienated his own creativity and sort of fell into enslavement to the commodity. Now, the commodity is really only man's own labor. The commodity is only his own creativity, but it has become a thing over against him, which is enslaving him. And I think it's kind of fascinating to realize to what extent a kind of a philosophical analysis underlies Marx's economics, that Marx really turned economics out of this sort of philosophical analysis, which may have been reason why he's a lousy economist, I don't know, because in a real sense he started out from a kind of a philosophical presupposition, and he's perhaps one of the a kind of fascinating example of a man who studied economics all his life from the standpoint of despising economics. You see, that for him money was a kind of a demon, an alien force controlling man. And so he studied economics, or he studied political economy, the way you study the enemy, the tactics of the enemy, in order to overcome him. Okay, so this is the sort of succession into the position which Marx takes up in the economic and philosophical manuscripts. Like Moses Hess, Marx believes in these manuscripts that the basic alienation of man is the economic alienation, by which he projects his own creativity into a commodity world, and then falls slave to the commodity world. And the ultimate symbol of this is money, and the whole capitalistic structure, which has become a kind of a thing world over against man, to which man has fallen slave. Now, actually, this kind of thinking, I mean, if you recognize it, is really very much what Christianity has always talked about as idolatry, you see. And Marx even talks about money as the golden calf and so on like that. He's really talking about idolatry, man falling slave to his own self-image and so forth. He sees this, as Feuerbach and Moses Hess did, as a critique or attack on religion and Christianity. But in a real sense, I think Christians can say this is not Christianity that he was attacking, but rather he was attacking something which Christianity itself has always attacked, namely idolatry, the enslavement of man to the golden calf over against him. So man, for Marx, man is basically the creator. He is the whole concept of the creator God is really a projection of man's own creative powers. Man is the free creator, and in his unfallen state, you might say, in his unfallen state, man would create purely for the joy of creating. In other words, he would not work in order to live. But he would live as a direct expression of his life. And that's, of course, exactly the way we sort of work around Holden Village. I mean, Marx would be, I think, delighted with Holden Village, because this is in many ways a kind of a realization of Marx's dream, where people do not make their work into an alien thing over against them. They do not work in order to get something, so their work just becomes a drudge thing in order to get some kind of money so they can live, but rather they work as a direct expression of their own creativity, and they don't have to hold on to their commodities, so to speak. Their commodities are not their life, but rather they just create, their commodities are what they produce are just an expression of their life, the expression of their free creativity. And this is, you know, when you create pottery and sculpture and all these things, not in order to get some money in order to live, but rather just an expression of the fact that you are living. And then you can kind of give all these things away at the end, you see, because these things are not your means to life, but they are simply an expression of your life. That's what Marx saw as the ideal state of man. That would be communist society, when man could create as a direct expression of his life, and not create in order to live. The creating in order to live, then, is man's enslavement. The fall of man, so to speak, that he has fallen slave to the sort of alienated products of his own work, and so he no longer creates as an expression of his life, but rather he lives a drudge existence, enslaved to his own commodities, which then become the means of his life. And it's this alienation of man's work which Marx sought to overcome through his analysis of the capitalistic system, and then finally his projection of how the capitalistic system would be overcome in the ideal communist society, when man would be reunited or reconciled to his own labor and once more create as an expression of his own free creativity. So in a real way, Marx's critique of capital is a kind of critique of the theology of the worldly god, the theology of money. He tended to use these kind of theological symbols quite a bit when he talked about political economy. Political economy is the theology of the worldly god, which is money, and which is this idol which man has projected over against himself and to which he has fallen slave. Money is the root expression of the golden calf on which all of the theoretical golden calves of the legal and the social and the religious systems are based. Now, this alienation of man's labor and its objectification in the form of commodities affects a reversal of the authentic relationship between man and nature. The outward world of products, the outward world of things, products, and so on, instead of being freely created as joyful expressions of man's creativity, now become the lord of his creativity. They become the master. And all of man's riches, all of man's creativity, become subservient to the making of the product or the making of the thing, whereas man himself now becomes increasingly impoverished. It's very important to realize that. Now, all of man's creativity, all of his riches flow out in a kind of subservient relationship to making the thing or the product, while man's own inner life becomes increasingly impoverished. Now, this concept of poverty is very fascinating in Marx because, in effect, he kind of fuses or identifies two kinds of poverty, which I think, might really be quite different. The one kind of poverty, of course, is man's external poverty, the poverty of his physical life, in which everything goes to the making of a kind of bloated capitalistic world, whereas the worker himself gets only a kind of a minimal amount of money that's just enough to keep him alive. So man's external impoverishment, whereas the workers who did all the work, according to Marx, because all of the value was based purely on their labor, they are just sort of barely kept alive, and all of their riches go into the making of this the capitalistic wealth. But behind this concept of the outer or physical impoverishment of the worker, he also has beneath this the concept of the inner impoverishment of man, which I think in many ways is really the deeper concern here, and certainly the deeper concern that emerges in these early manuscripts. Beneath the outer impoverishment is the inner impoverishment, that man's spiritual life, or perhaps he wouldn't like to use spiritual, creative life, his inner human creative life has become alienated from him. It's become all projected into a world of things, and he has become subservient to this outer world. He has become alienated from his own creativity. And therefore, according to Marx, it's not enough to overcome the impoverishment of the worker simply by giving him better working conditions and better wages and so forth. And here's where Marxism sort of parted company with what Lenin called the trade union consciousness. The trade union consciousness is concerned only with the external impoverishment of the worker. It wants to get in better working conditions, better better wages and better benefits and all this kind of stuff. And this, of course, has to a large extent proved quite successful in the West. But Marxism, to some extent, fought the trade union consciousness because they felt that that in itself could not solve the problem, that it was not enough just to overcome the external impoverishment of man. But the real crux of the thing was to overcome the inner impoverishment of man, the alienation of man's creativity to the thing or to the commodity world. And that mere trade union benefits could not do. Now, this doesn't mean Marx completely ignored the external amelioration of the worker's physical condition, but there was a kind of ambivalence in Marx and in Marxism generally toward mere trade union benefits, because there was this feeling that, that the real impoverishment would not be overcome in that way, that we must sort of overcome the whole conditions of alienated labor in order to really get to the root of the problem. Here's a little passage from the Economic Philosophical Manuscripts, which talks about the way he saw the impoverishment of man. The worker becomes poorer the more wealth he produces. The worker becomes an ever cheaper commodity the more goods he creates. The devaluation of the human world increases in direct relationship to the increase of the value of the world of things. You see, this is not just an economic analysis. I mean, when you listen to that, you see something deeper here of an analysis of the inner impoverishment of man. The devaluation of the human world increases in direct relationship to the increase in the value of the world of things. The very physical existence of the worker is finally reduced to a marginal part of the cost of production. The worker does not work as an expression of his life, but rather he is barely kept alive in the most minimal conditions, only that he can work. This is not Marx anymore, but this is a commentary on what he's saying here. He lives in hovels and dark cellars without the most elementary conditions of light and air and decent food at the same time that all of his work goes into constant enrichment of the world of commodities. The worker becomes a blasted and dehumanized adjunct to the labor process, misshapen in mind and body. The more his work manifests an increasing opulence, beauty, and intelligence. Now, this kind of sharp antithesis in Marx, of course, is based on the conditions of labor in the 1840s in England. This is where he was doing his analysis. It's obvious, I think, that it is less true today, this kind of sharp antithesis, but it was certainly true then that you had this kind of burgeoning industrial revolution creating this enormous explosion of wealth, and the people that were doing it all were living in the most incredible dehumanized conditions. You know, I mean, we're children working 12 hours a day, women, men, just, you know, kind of barely kept alive as slaves to this industrial process. And you have to kind of remember that that's the context in which Marx did his analysis. And his analysis came out of a very deep sense of moral outrage at this condition of the worker who was creating this industrial revolution of enormous explosion of wealth and yet had really fallen down to the most dehumanized possible conditions. That was the kind of moral outrage, which is the basis on which Marx went to his analysis, so to speak. Now, of course, today, so, you know, trade union organizations and so forth have to a large extent changed some of that very dehumanized condition of the worker that existed in Marx's own time. But I think we have to recognize that in a real sense, this doesn't completely undo Marx's basic concern, because underneath that physical impoverishment is still the inner impoverishment of the spirit, where man becomes a slave to the work process. And I think this is just as true today of the, you know, $50,000 a year executive as it was of the worker in those days, that in many ways people feel that they don't live, but they just exist in order to work. They may get enormous amount of money today for their work. They may have a very opulent home and two cars and so forth, and yet in some ways they still feel themselves alienated from their own work, enslaved to the work process, rather than having their work as a real kind of direct creative expression of their being. And this was the sort of inner impoverishment which lies beneath Marx's analysis. Now, Marx then went on from this analysis of the self-alienation of man into the work process and the creation of the thing world or the commodity world as the sort of master. He went on from this analysis, sort of human analysis, to a kind of projection of this analysis into the class struggle. In other words, he felt that this inner alienation of man then found a social expression in the form of the class struggle, that this took a kind of class form in which the worker alienates himself into the commodities, and then he raises up a new class